A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. There are 40,000 Asian elephants left in the world right now, tucked into the mountainous forests of the continent. Asian elephants used to roam all of India and far up into China, almost as far north as Beijing. But as humans have expanded into the areas where elephants used to live, the elephants have retreated further into the forests. About 13,000 of those elephants are doing some form of labor on behalf of human beings. Maybe a third to half are doing tricks in captivity or giving rides to tourists in elephant preserves. The remainder are working, logging, or carrying passengers or food or water or medicine across forested areas, going where the roads cannot, especially at the height of monsoon season. About 8,000 to 9,000 Asian elephants work with us in this capacity. But that's just a rough estimate, says Jacob Schell, a professor of geography and urban studies at Temple University. There hasn't been a formal census, and the work is largely invisible to the urban occupants of these countries, or those of us who visit them. That invisible work, and the complicated relationships between a tamed but not domesticated elephant and its often lifetime handler, is the subject of Jacob Schell's new book, Giants of the Monsoon Forest. He went to the tiny logging villages and covert forest camps in India and Burma, where elephants and humans are working together today, as they have for centuries, not only to document a disappearing way of life, but to figure out whether it might hold the key to the Asian elephant's survival in an all-too-human world. Jacob Schell joins us from Philadelphia. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I'm really excited to talk about the work on elephants that I've been doing.
That's kind of my first question. What drew you, a geographer and an urban studies professor, to look at elephants in the first place? Because they don't exactly show up in cities very often.
Yeah. Well, in graduate school, I was really interested in transportation issues. And in particular, I became interested in how people move things around in secret. Throughout a lot of that research period, I was interested in things like waterfronts and canals. But eventually, I became interested in animals and how people use animals as a means of transportation or follow animals or use animals as a means of navigation for moving things around in secret. So you can imagine something like smuggling things across mountain ranges using mules. That's something that kind of looms larger in American history, for example. So ultimately, this led me in the direction of these relatively small, marginal, usually overlooked communities in the borderlands of Burma or Myanmar and India that are using elephants for something like this purpose. They're not always moving things around in secret, but certainly in a kind of a less visible forest zone. Most of these communities are upland minorities in a kind of mountainous and heavily forested area. And this is a part of the world that experiences some of the most intense monsoon conditions on the planet. And so when this happens, you have what little local road infrastructure there is washes over or becomes obstructed by mudslides, felled trees, boulders. And so the elephants become uniquely necessary to move things around. And some of the people that I talk about are using elephants precisely for moving things around in secret in the forest.
One of the other groups that you contrasted that work with was the Burmese government's logging program in central Burma.
which kind of functions radically differently. What does that look like in comparison?
Yeah. Since the time of British colonialism, and actually this goes back to pre-colonial times too, there's this government-managed practice of elephant-based logging. And it's in particular organized around logging teak, which is a very valuable timber because teak is naturally water resistant. So most deck furniture or deck flooring is oftentimes built out of teak. In the 19th century, most ships were built out of teak because it has this naturally water resistant properties. And the issue with teak from the standpoint of logging is that the best teak only grows on the tips of these very difficult to access hills. In central and some of northern Burma. It's difficult to build logging roads that go all the way up to these hilltops. And so what the sort of standard practice has been until very recently, meaning just within the last few years, is that elephants are instead employed, usually at a scale of several thousand elephants, to actually be the ones who, along with their human handlers, who would be called Uzis in Burma and Mahouts in Indian and English too, they'll go up to these hilltops, they'll fell these trees, and the elephants will drag or sometimes carry these logs down to some sort of depot or sawmill. And the whole thing is organized around several dozen so-called elephant logging villages, which are really fascinating places to visit. One of the things that really fascinated me in particular about them, and this is true with the communities that are using elephants for transportation too, is that the elephants are released into the forest on a nightly basis. So thus far, it may sort of sound as if, like, surely these elephants are kept in chains all throughout their lives. And they are certainly sort of coerced to some extent into this relationship with humans. But every single night, they're also permitted to wander the forest relatively freely. They have some sort of chain loosely connecting their two forelegs, but they have total freedom to wander wherever they want to wander in the open forest, which is highly significant because it means that the elephants, in addition to be able to recreate and sleep and feed themselves in the forest, they can also find mates. And elephants that are employed under these conditions reproduce at a far higher rate than elephants that are kept cooped up in zoos or, for that matter, in tourist compounds. So that's highly significant. And the sort of balance between the humans working with the elephants in these elephant logging villages who have to go fetch the elephant out of the forest every morning and the elephant's own needs are really fascinating to see in action. It's a very delicate kind of balance.
Yeah, I mean, it all seems like a super delicate balance because on the one hand, you have elephants working to help humans pull trees down from a forest that they need to survive. And at the same time, you have other humans who also need that forest to survive. It seems like a really complicated web. I mean, who has a stake in the existence of the forest and this continued relationship?
Yeah. Well, that was something I was certainly thinking about while doing this research. And in many ways, the way in which teak logging in central Burma happens has been somewhat sustainable, or what we would probably describe as sustainable, up until relatively recently. But with the economic opening of Burma to global markets, that seems to be proving less and less and less true. And in fact, there's a kind of quasi-moratorium that's been placed on elephant logging over the last couple of years for this exact reason. They're slowly running out of forest cover. So I began to think that that particular practice where elephants are used by these humans in the forest in order to do logging might not be the most sustainable practice going forward if the idea is ultimately to conserve the forest, which the elephants and some of the humans too need in order to survive. And so ultimately in the book, what I wind up arguing is that it's really these cross-forest transportation practices which several thousand of the elephants are facilitating. And this is happening more in northern Burma and also at the northeastern tip of India, which borders northern Burma. It's really those practices which I think have a lot more promise as a kind of long-term conservation strategy, where essentially you have humans and elephants working together to preserve the forest, to maintain the forest as a source of value and a source of power. I became especially interested while doing that leg of the research in a ethnic group in northern Burma called the Kachin. the Kachin have had one of the world's longest running civil wars with the Central Burmese military. By some metrics, it actually started as early as 1961 and is ongoing. And the Kachin Independence Army actually has an elephant brigade system, about 50 to 60 elephants overall, who transport various goods around the Kachin forest in secret, out of sight from the Central Burmese military. And even though I certainly wouldn't advocate that civil warfare, it can be useful or necessary for the survival of the Asian elephants, that's not really how I look at it. This is an example of humans and elephants working together to derive value and power out of the forest in a way that maintains the forest and keeps it in place rather than cutting it all down and replacing it with farms and cities and things like that.
What would you say to the argument that we should just free all the elephants and let them run in the forest without any human influence and just set up nature reserves instead?
Yeah, well, I think my view on that is that it sounds like something which would be ideal. And if we lived in an ideal world, I would say let's absolutely do that rather than utilizing trained elephants who've been captured out of the forest or born in captivity in some cases for monsoon time transportation practices, which is more what I advocate in the book. The problem is that we don't live in that kind of ideal world or that kind of ideal situation. And in reality, deforestation, which is the major thing which is pushing Asian elephants in particular to the brink of extinction. Deforestation is a major factor in this part of the world. I don't think it's going to be particularly likely that regions like Northeast India or countries like Burma are going to be able to institute forest preserves that are sufficiently expansive. We need to imagine some way of human beings and these giant animals co-inhabiting this very, very crowded part of the planet. And otherwise, I don't realistically see a path forward for the Asian elephant species.
So what's the exact mechanism that, I guess, keeps elephants in the workforce and works to stop deforestation? How does that balance play out, do you think, in those northern regions that you were talking about where elephants are used for transportation? Because I confess that I was initially one of those indignant outside observers who was all like, we should just leave them there. They'll be fine on their own. And I'm curious if you can outline more specifically what that looks like or where you see it working well.
Right. Yeah. Well, so I think that the one of the questions for me was, if you look at the remaining forest cover in this part of the world, you're going to see that, one, there's very little forest cover left in these spaces between India and China. Two, there is actually one big chunk of forest land, basically in this border region between northern Burma and northeast India. And I was certainly thinking while doing the research, well, how come so much forest cover has actually remained in that region? At first, I thought, well, maybe the soil is bad, so it wouldn't make sense for agriculture. But that doesn't appear to be true. There's one particular region which is hard fought over between the Kachin Independence Army and the Central Burmese military, called the Hukong Valley. And one of the points of contention is that the various development interests connected to the Central Burmese military want to replace much of the forest cover with sugar and palm oil plantations. So apparently, from their point of view, the soil is just fine, and the whole area has tons of potential to be developable for permanent agriculture. And yet, thus far, that's not what's happened in these areas. And that has a lot to do with the fact that the major dominant ethnic groups in these regions are traditionally much more associated with practices which don't require eliminating forest cover. Now, this could be small-scale logging, so like logging that allows the forest to recover. It could be mining, which tends to loom rather large in these regions, like mining gold out of rivers or mining jade is a major industry in Kachin State. And transportation, cross-forest transportation has also been another really important source of livelihood for these particular communities. And it's not just the Kachin. I should mention other groups like the Kamti and the Adi groups, which traditionally up through the present have derived livelihood and value from activities which don't displace forest cover. They found other ways of deriving value from the territory. And that to me is very significant and sort of inherently means that these groups even when they sometimes hunt elephants, like for meat or for ivory, although that's not very common, but even when they do that, they aren't as much of a threat to the Asian elephants as human activities that eradicate forest cover would be. So that was the sort of dynamic that I became very interested in while doing this research.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you said about the elephants evolving out of these valleys that are now populated with humans leads me to wonder about the Asian elephant's counterpart, which is the African elephant, which also has a history of domestication, but has never really been used in the same way that the Asian elephant has and continues to be. So why did one elephant get this central role in this human-elephant relationship while the other one is sort of just faded back to the savannah?
Yeah, this sort of interesting counterexample. In Africa, you don't have this continuous pressure of deforestation happening for thousands of years in a row in the same way that you do in Asia. In Asia, you have these intensive agricultural civilizations, especially in India and China, eradicating forest cover, replacing forest cover with farmland. There isn't really an analogous process of multi-millennial deforestation which happens in Africa. And so my own theory about this is that it's ultimately this process of deforestation and of migration of some humans away from the agricultural civilizations in Asia towards this remaining forested zone alongside the elephants, which gives rise to this culture of Asian elephant taming, capture, and domestication in Asia, which doesn't really have a counterpart in Africa. Even though there are these sort of interesting, sort of shorter, more truncated histories in Africa of humans sometimes capturing African elephants and using them for some kind of human-imposed labor. What looms relatively large in much Western memory is that African elephants in classical Greek and Roman times were captured out of North Africa and were put to work doing combat in battle, which certainly wouldn't be something I would ever support happening now, but that is something which happened historically. And there's also some sort of tenuous suggestions that maybe some indigenous peoples in sub-Saharan Africa practice some kind of African elephant domestication at various times, but certainly never something as continuous as what you see in Asia.
So what you're describing happening in Asia over the course of these thousands of years, and what you're sort of suggesting for the future of elephants, of how we save them, is to preserve this, what you call an interspecies alliance between the two. And I'm just curious how, I mean, obviously we can't know specifically, you know, we can only sketch a picture through various historical documents, but how did this evolution, this like co-evolution occur, do you think? Do you hypothesize? Do we really even know?
Yeah, well, so what I think happened maybe from about 1000 BC onward is that as Asian elephants were retreating into these forest areas, you could imagine different elephants being born with maybe different personalities. Some elephants maybe would be born with a very anti-human personality and also wishing to go back into the valley areas where the farms now are. And so those elephants would be likely to be killed because they're going back into the farmland and they're being killed by humans. And you could maybe imagine an elephant with a different kind of anti-human personality, which prefers to stay inside of the forest refuge. But this elephant, too, would be at a major disadvantage. It could be killed by hunters, or it could find itself isolated. But you could also imagine an elephant that is just born with a personality that inclines the elephant to be very friendly to humans and to want to kind of work cooperatively with humans in some way. And that elephant would have a decent shot at surviving this process of gradual forest diminishment, provided that the humans that it cooperated with permitted the elephant to wander the forest every night, because that's the only way that that elephant is going to be able to reproduce with other elephants and pass on its genes and its traits. So you need to imagine a number of sort of very kind of subtle, sensitive processes shaking out in a particular way. But I think ultimately this is the best explanation for how South Asia and Southeast Asia wound up with these particular cultures of elephant domestication that we still see some remaining aspects of today. it's not the same set of processes as how we get domesticated cattle or horses or dogs, where humans ultimately wind up selectively breeding those particular species in order to get a separate species from the wild progenitor of the species. Domesticated dogs are genetically distinct from wolves, that kind of thing. That never happens with Asian elephants. Domesticated Asian elephants are genetically exactly the same as wild Asian elephants. Oftentimes, wild elephants who are captured out of the wild are the ones who become the trained elephants. And then trained elephants occasionally will run away and will go back into the forest and become wild elephants themselves. So it's a different kind of situation than we might be accustomed to when thinking about other domesticated animals like horses and dogs.
So are you hopeful about elephants' futures? I mean, knowing that climate change is rapidly increasing and turning into climate cataclysm, so we'll have more floods and I guess more work opportunities for elephants, but at the same time there's also a lot more economic pressure in the places where they are living in the forest. So do you feel like on measure things are looking good for elephants or not so good?
I'm not that hopeful. I mean, I can get very swept up by my own various proposals, but what I think is likelier to happen is that the South and Southeast Asian forests will probably contract and contract and contract. More elephants will wind up in enclosed, controlled kinds of human-imposed environments by well-meaning humans, but that the elephants who find themselves in those situations won't reproduce at a high enough rate to reverse the sort of gloomy demographic trend of the species. So I think several projections basically have the species extinct or very close to extinct by the end of this century. Again, there's only 40,000 of them left at this point. I think the prospects for the species are pretty bleak. I think for some Western listeners, it might be worth thinking about the contrast with African elephants, who are also in a dire situation, but the number of African elephants who are still alive is about 450,000. So it's an order of magnitude difference. And I think sometimes Western observers or people who care about elephants see imagery of ivory poaching and assume or draw the conclusion that ivory poaching is the single major threat towards elephants of all kinds. And that's what's pushing these giant majestic species towards extinction. And it seems like that is a central threat in Africa. But again, African elephants are not as close to the brink of extinction as Asian elephants, not by a long shot. And in Asia, the major threat to elephants is not ivory poaching, it's deforestation.
A big part of Jacob's book are the stories told by the mahouts about their elephants, including some wild stories of elephants outsmarting their humans when it comes to leaving the forest for work and problem solving with teak logs that even human loggers couldn't figure out. Find them all in Jacob Shell's new book, Giants of the Monsoon Forest. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.